been a long day. This is docket 50767, Cromer versus Wilson. And, counsel, are we ready? All right, Mr. Sampson, if you want to begin.
Honorable Supreme Court Justices, counsel, may it please the court. I'm David Sampson, counsel for the appellants, Mr. and Mrs. Cromer. I would like to spend about 8 to 9 minutes addressing you initially, and then if I could reserve the remainder for rebuttal, please. This case gives the court the opportunity to review the plain and clear language that is set forth in the statute, NRS 41.133, which is beautiful in its simplicity in stating that if an offender has been convicted of the crime which resulted into an injury to the victim, the judgment of conviction is, and this is the clear part, conclusive evidence of all facts necessary to impose civil liability for the injury. And the statute is not written in a way that lends itself to loopholes, backdoors, or caveats. It states quite clearly the intended result, that liability, that civil liability, be imposed upon the individual who has been convicted. And there are statutes that talk about a rebuttable presumption. I myself am familiar with this case law regarding spoliation, in which there may be a presumption that the spoiled material, spoiled evidence may have been bad for the party who spoiled it. Certainly we have statutes and rules that have been written that way. This statute is not one of them. And there is a strong difference, and I think this is pivotal, there's a strong significant difference between establishing negligence and imposing civil liability. We can establish negligence in a case, yet if the plaintiff is proven to be 51% contributorily at fault, comparatively at fault, civil liability will not be imposed. And I would submit to the court, the only way you impose civil liability is when there is a judgment that requires the defendant to pay. And the only way you fully impose civil liability is when the defendant pays fully.
But counsel, the issue seems to be, though, how much and whether you're still allowed to put forth contributory negligence to get to that issue of how much.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is the point. And it's akin to strict liability, or in the criminal realm, felony murder. And we have a case directly on point, which is Warmbrook versus Blanchard, states that once a court enters summary judgment in favor of a party on an issue, then it is error to submit the question of that party's negligence to the jury. And I would submit that's what NRS 41.133 conclusively establishes.
Are we supposed to not read at all the contributory negligence statute?
Well, the contributory negligence statute was addressed by this court in Stapp v. Hilton, which states that it is only applicable in situations where comparative negligence may be properly asserted. I would submit to the court, in a situation where, under by statute, all evidence necessary to impose civil liability has been established. And what is necessary to impose civil liability? Duty, breach, causation, those all establish negligence. But you can't impose civil liability if there's comparative fault. The only way to impose that civil liability is to abolish comparative fault.
Well, it's a degree of fault. It's not until you get to 51%, you're not doing away with civil liability per se.
Well, you're doing away with at least a portion of it if there's so much as 1%. And the statute doesn't say all facts necessary to, again, give rise to a presumption or to impose partial liability, but to impose liability. The jury instruction that was given in this case was such that the jury could have come back and said, we find plaintiff Aaron Cromer to be 51% responsible and there would have been no civil liability imposed whatsoever. That door was left open and it should have been closed. The facts of this particular case make it particularly egregious because this court in Downing v. Marilla held an order for a passenger. This is a passenger who's riding with someone who is drunk. And in Downing, this court ruled that in order for the passenger to be held responsible, they must have actual knowledge of the impaired state of their driver. We didn't have that here. Mr. Wilson, Mr. Cromer both testified they had no idea Mr. Wilson was far too inebriated to operate a vehicle. And in fact, the respondent's own medical expert testified that given Mr. Cromer's blood alcohol content in the emergency room when he was in his coma, he would have been far too under the influence to be able to appreciate that Mr. Wilson was too inebriated to operate a motor vehicle. And so there was no evidence about Mr. Cromer and whether he had an appreciation for the circumstances as he entered the vehicle, as this court required in Downing. Instead, What we had was arguments from the respondent, from Mr. Wilson, that this was some 20-year accident in the making. The phrase Russian roulette was tossed out. And the argument was that things Mr. Comer did 20 years before the accident date result in his comparative negligence for this particular accident. That Mr. Wilson and Mr. Comer, from time to time, would get together, both would drink.
You challenged the giving of the comparative instruction.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And you're not challenging, per se, the giving of that instruction here on appeal.
No, I believe we are challenging it, that it's inappropriate to give it, first of all, because the statute requires that civil liability be imposed.
But you're challenging based upon the statute as opposed to an abuse of discretion in giving the statute by the district court judge.
We are arguing it based on the statute as well as the fact that there was no evidence presented to the court whatsoever.
Okay.
That Mr. Comer appreciated, would have had any idea that it would have had the actual knowledge that the Downing court required.
Did you make a Rule 50 motion during or after trial?
Your Honor, at this point in time, I do not specifically recall if we did, it would have been part of the record, and I wouldn't dispute what the record indicates. I apologize. The trial was 2 years ago.
There was a motion for partial summary judgment early on, right?
There was a motion for summary judgment previously based on the statute, saying the statute does impose civil liability. We asked that you impose civil liability. That was rejected.
The statute, though, actually, and the wording is curious, is conclusive evidence of all facts necessary to impose civil liability. Is there any other statute in your work on this this appeal from another jurisdiction that uses comparable language that you found?
Not that I...
So you don't know if that statute's a borrow or original to Nevada?
I do not myself. I apologize. The other two issues in the case is specifically involving Mrs. Comer. There is no dispute. Mr. Wilson did not ever cause any direct harm to Mrs. Comer. Mrs. Comer's loss of consortium claim stemmed entirely from the injuries Mr. Comer suffered as a result of this incident. The jury found Mr. Wilson to be 75% responsible for the injuries Mr. Comer suffered, and yet found Mr. Wilson in the same verdict form to be 0% responsible for any loss of consortium. Now, certainly, it was available and an option to the jury, as inhumane as it may have been, to find that, as they did, Mr. Wilson is 75% responsible for the injuries Mr. Comer received, and would therefore, as a result, have to be 75% responsible for Felicia Comer's loss of consortium, but those damages were zero. That option, as inhumane as it would have been, was available to the jury. They didn't take it. They simply returned a defense verdict on Felicia Comer's claim, which is completely improper. If there had been a zero damages awarded to Felicia Comer, she would have been able to bring a motion pursuant to Donaldson v. Anderson for addictor. And Donaldson, this court held, and it involved the wrongful death of a child. It's a rare life that is monetarily worthless and does not trigger some type of measurable sorrow in a surviving parent. We would have been able, Mrs. Comer would have been able to argue, it's a rare marriage indeed, I certainly would hope so, that is monetarily worthless and wouldn't trigger some type of measurable sorrow.
But is it not possible?
It certainly is possible. But the problem is we don't know. That's not what the jury did here. I mean, certainly if the jury had said, yes, Mr. Wilson, you are 75% responsible for the harm and for the loss of consortium claim, but there were no damages, that'd be a whole other issue. What we have here is the jury saying, you are not, Mr. Wilson, responsible for any damages suffered by Mrs. Comer. And that's clearly improper. They already ruled that he was 75% responsible for any such damages. And in the circumstance, the evidence was that Mrs. Comer went from having an able-bodied husband to having her husband standing by his side for 5 weeks while he was in a coma and proceeding to then, in his recovery stage, change his diapers, feed him, help him learn to speak, and walk all over again with a walker. Now, again, had the verdict come back, we would have been in a situation where we could have addressed additor and looked at the evidence in the session that way. But the verdict was simply a defense verdict against Mrs. Comer when they already ruled Mr. Wilson was, in fact, responsible.
Well, help me out on the plaintiff's verdict, because it seems almost inconsistent. You have on the plaintiff's jury verdict a
yes,
line
ma'am.
Through the we, the jury, in the above entitled action, find for the plaintiff, Felicia Comer, and against William Wilson, and assess without reduction for contributory damages at, and then they draw a blank.
They drew a line. Correct.
And then you have the next one, which is verdict for defendants. So you have two arguably inconsistent verdicts. My question is, and I don't want to eat up your time, was there any issue made in front of the judge to ask the jury to clarify that apparent inconsistency? Well,
Your Honor, we filed a motion to clarify that verdict, asked to have the judge rectify
but
what was...
But after the jury was released.
The jury has been excused, correct.
Okay.
That is correct. In our motion, it was denied, and the judge said, that the verdict was not, he did not find it inconsistent. I think at the very least, it's certainly inconsistent to say we find for the plaintiff and then turn around and say we find for the defendant. It needs to be rectified. And all we're asking under that scenario is that it go back on a damages trial only. Depending on how the court rules on the comparative fault issue, it would either be a 100% or 75% fault within a damages trial on that point. As to the offer of judgment was set on June 15, 2004. It was in the amount of $1.5 million. In October 2007, the jury came back and awarded $6.3 million when you add in the additor that was awarded by the court. There's no question Mr. Wilson did not obtain a more favorable result. I've assessed the factors from RTTC Communications versus Saratoga. None of them have anything to do with subsequent settlement negotiations or talks of insurance policy limits. In fact, the only time I've ever heard this court address an assessment of policy limits is when it's in terms of talking about whether a settlement is in good faith or not. It was brought in good faith and can be approved by the court. Outside of that, we have a case, Mr. Cromer against Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson was given an opportunity, have judgment in at $1.5 million. The choice was made to reject that. And the court's discussion of an offer of settlement in August of 2005, a year and 2 months later, to envision entering judgment in the amount of $1.2 million, and that somehow that would undermine an offer of judgment that was sent a year and 2 months previously, doesn't follow. And to penalize Mr. Cromer for a year down the road after the offer of judgment's already been rejected for over a year now, trying to still work something out, and to penalize him under his offer of judgment, I think would be wholly inappropriate. With that, I'd like to retain the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very
certainly
much.
May. Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Good afternoon.
Mark Brown and Josh Aiklin on behalf of Mr. Wilson with Lewis, Brisbois, Bisgard, and Smith. I'd like to first start with the comparative negligence issue. The statute that has been argued in the briefs asserting that there is no basis to use the comparative negligence statute. That statute, the language of it, this court has already stated in its prior rulings that that statute is inherently unclear. That's in the Langdon case versus Matamoros. And it's unclear, particularly with respect to the application of other statutes, including the comparative negligence statute. And our position on it is that in the absence of a clear statutory provision that would state that the comparative negligence statute shouldn't apply, the comparative negligence statute should be allowed to be applied in all cases where the only claims involved are negligence. In this case, the only claim asserted by the Mr. Cromer was a claim for negligence, and that was clarified at the outset of the trial. There was no claim for intentional wrongdoing or anything else. With respect to the issue of the additor for the pain and suffering, that's a matter that's at the discretion of the trial judge. He was there to listen to the entire case. He heard the extensive evidence concerning the nature and extent of Mr. Cromer's injuries. He heard the testimony that Mr. Cromer suffered from incomplete quadriplegia. He has a limited use of his hands, his arms, his legs, and he has other severe injuries as well. The court was able to hear all the testimony, evaluate the expert witnesses, and there's approximately a dozen experts that testified in this case when you take into account treating physicians as well. The trial judge, Judge Denton, was able to reach a decision on what he thought was an appropriate additor in that case, and he added $4 million as an additor, $2 million past and $2 million future. With respect to the loss of consortium claim, on the loss of consortium claim, that's an independent claim that has to be established by the evidence. there is no rule that says that simply because the plaintiff on the negligence claim prevails that the spouse is automatically entitled to damages on the loss of consortium. The jury verdicts on that issue are consistent. There's nothing inconsistent with them whatsoever. The verdicts that were available to the jury provided one that they could find in favor of the defendant. They didn't do that. They found in favor of Mr. Cromer. There's another jury verdict that said they could find in favor of defendant Wilson or in favor of Felicia Cromer. The jury did not find in favor of Felicia Cromer. They specifically found against Felicia Cromer on her claim of loss of consortium. that left one verdict left to be filled out, and that was the amount of damages to be specified. Consistent with the finding against Alicia Cromer, the jury put a line through the amount indicating no damages, specific damages to be awarded for Alicia Cromer. So the decision by the jury on that issue was consistent. Regarding the offer of judgment, this court has, for decades, since the Beattie decision and all the cases subsequent to there, had the trial courts look at several factors to consider whether, in the trial court's discretion, attorney's fees, prejudgment interest can be awarded based on a rejection of an offer of judgment. One of those factors is whether the rejection of the offer by the defendant is grossly unreasonable and in bad faith. The trial court in this case, Judge Denton, looked at the end of the case at the evidence in the case. He looked at the circumstances surrounding the offer for $1.5 million by the Cromers to, by Aaron Cromer to Mr. Wilson, and found that based on the fact that Mr. Wilson had no assets, did not have $1.5 million, it was not unreasonable for Mr. Wilson to reject that offer, not accept that offer. There's been, the briefing goes into details regarding circumstances regarding a failed agreement between the parties, but regardless of whether the details regarding that are looked at, the trial court properly evaluated whether it was unreasonable for Mr. Wilson to reject an offer that he could not obviously pay. The court considered that to be acceptable, that he rejected the offer, and in his discretion decided not to award attorney's fees and prejudgment interest.
I'd like to get back to the application of 41133 and 141.
Okay.
Counsel's indicated that, first of all, the application of the comparative negligence statute was error, and that there are no facts to support the giving of a comparative negligence instruction. I'd like to just hear your side on that.
Well, regarding the facts, there was overwhelming evidence in the case that both Mr. Wilson and Mr. Cromer had on the weekend of the accident engaged in activity that was way out of control. It was evidence that they had both been using drugs and cocaine during that weekend and been using it extensively and been getting intoxicated throughout the weekend and on the day of the accident itself. And they were both taking turns driving the vehicles. All that evidence, and there's hundreds of pages of transcript testimony regarding that. So there certainly was a factual basis for the jury to consider that there was comparative negligence by Mr. Cromer in going out and drinking and excessively for an entire weekend and then going out and getting in a vehicle with Mr. Wilson. And they were two people who were excessively partying together throughout the entire weekend. And so the jury found that there was comparative negligence.
How do you harmonize the two statutes, 41133 and 41141, if found, for example, contributory or comparative and 25%, that would have been liability extinguishing, and wouldn't that be in conflict with 41133, which says the judgment of conviction is conclusive evidence of all facts necessary to impose civil liability? That's the argument on the other side, that you can't apply the comparative negligence statute because it threatens to destroy liability, which is conclusively presumed when you have a judgment of conviction for a serious offense. Can you address your side of that argument for me?
Yes, Your Honor. Proximate cause is not eliminated just because of that statute saying that it's conclusive as to liability. There are many instances in which you could have more than one proximate cause for an accident. It's not the position of the respondent in this case that the statute doesn't say what it does. It's conclusive of liability. But what the position of the respondent is that saying that it's conclusive of liability does not eliminate other proximate causes for an accident. For example, if we had a situation where we had an individual speeding and there was a pedestrian, and the pedestrian was not, it was dark, it was late at night, and they weren't in the crosswalk. There's no reason why a jury couldn't come back and find that there were two proximate causes for that accident. Both the pedestrian, who was walking in a dark, unlit area outside a crosswalk at night across the street, and in our case, that's the injured party, and that's the defendant, and then the plaintiff is the driver of the vehicle who is driving excessively. They could find two proximate causes for that accident. There's nothing inconsistent in having both those statutes operate together, both the comparative negligence statute and the statute regarding imposition of civil liability in a criminal.
But if the findings had been the reverse, 25-75 running the other direction, there would have been no recovery.
That's correct.
So that would be liability defeating in that sense.
It's defeating the sense of liability in that proximate cause was determined by the jury not to be related to the particular act that there was a felony for.
Okay.
But would that not be an absurd result in light of the language that says impose civil liability for the injury?
It's not an absurd result at all. The court's old decision under the Downing case, for instance, back when the assumption, I know the law was different, but it gives another good example for the court. In 1966, when the Downing case was there, the court looked at it and said, that time when assumption of risk applied, that if the passenger fully was aware of what they were doing when they got into that vehicle, a jury could have come back and said there was no award whatsoever to that passenger for what they did. In this case, the comparative negligence statute wasn't abrogated by the other statute. It applies. And as it applies, it gives the opportunity for the jury to consider the proximate causes, different proximate causes for the accident.
So I guess plaintiff's view is sense that you've almost got a default situation here. You don't have affirmative defenses that would apply. You wouldn't have the application of comparative negligence. And so it's a matter of simply the plaintiff in these cases proving up damages.
That appears to be their position.
Right. What about a statute of limitations, for example?
What about it?
A statute of limitations, for example, would be analogous, because the absence of a time defaulted claim is in a sense necessary to produce liability. So I suppose you could carry it out that far.
I heard some of the interesting discussion on the last one, but I'm not sure I could stretch that out, all of that argument. I understand counsel's trying to make an argument it's like a strict liability situation, but it's not. Strict liability is entirely.
Did you find any other states that have a similar conflict between a conclusive presumption conviction statute and comparative negligence defense statute?
Not a comparative negligence statute that I recall, but this matter was briefed a few years ago regarding this whole issue before Judge Denton, and I believe there was arguments where we had cases arguing that comparative negligence should apply, and in those cases, I believe that there are some states that if there was a search query stuck in using similar language, a quote, some similar language that we have in our statute that would pull up. There are some states with very similar language, very close to it.
Anything else?
No, nothing else, Your Honor. There was an evidentiary issue, but I think the briefs adequately addressed those issues.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Mr. Sampson, you got a little bit of time left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address briefly the limitations. The statute of limitations would be jurisdictional, and I think the statute that read you would impose liability would presuppose that the court would have jurisdiction first to hear the case in the first instance, and so I think that would handle the statute of limitations situation.
but in your view, all other affirmative defenses would be inapplicable.
I believe when the statute says you are to impose liability, that you are to impose liability. It's because it is a significant crime. It is a conviction of a significant crime. And this court already held in the Langan case that we're not talking about traffic tickets. We're not talking about minor issues. Drunk driving is not a minor issue. It's not a minor point. It's a significant problem and ought to be dealt with significantly, much in the same way that felony murder, when someone's in the commission of a felony and someone died. There are no causation questions. There are no issues in terms of double, multiple proximate causes, as Respondent's counsel has indicated. Someone dies in the commission of a felony, it's felony murder, and there's no way around it. Same thing here. When someone is injured as a result of your commission of a felony drunk driving, you are going to be responsible. And the state of Nevada is not going to let you escape that by legal maneuvering and arguing causation. We are going to, as the statute says, impose liability. And it doesn't say impose partial. I'm sorry.
As you make that argument, that's only half of it. You're still back to what you're using, the punishment. In this case, what are the dollars?
Correct. And a damages award, as Justice Paragraph indicated previously, that can go to court. I certainly am not indicating that you get a default and you get to prove up and ask for whatever damages you want. The respondent and an attorney for a drunk driver could certainly come in and argue that the damages ought to be in a reasonable award and make sense. But to say we're not going to impose liability when the statute, I don't see how you get around the words. It doesn't say that we establish negligence.
Well, the question within the question then is, that is the case, then this comparative negligence, why can it not be used to offset those damages?
Well, again, it's
for the jury to take into consideration.
Because it's not to be used to offset the damages if it relates to liability. You want to make an argument as to what the actual damages are, that would make sense. But to say we're going to argue liability in the face of a statute that says you are to impose liability wouldn't be a proper reading of the statute, I'd submit to the court. You're going to say, as we indicated previously when Respondent was discussing, you're going to leave the door open so that there's not going to be any liability imposed at all. If there's a 51-50 or 50-49 or a 75-25 the other way in this particular case, there would have been no liability imposed whatsoever. And the statute doesn't indicate it's all facts necessary to impose at least 50% liability to protect against a zero recovery. It says all facts necessary to impose civil liability for the injury. That's full civil liability for the injury. There's no other way to read it. It doesn't say there's a presumption. It doesn't say you establish negligence but then have a trial as to whether there's a second proximate cause. It's a decision that was made by our legislature, by the rules drafters, to indicate that that's how important fighting against drunk driving is. In the state of Nevada, if you drive drunk and someone is injured, you are going to take responsibility.
This statute is not specifically aimed at just drunk driving.
That's correct. It's at all felony. It's the judgment of the conviction, and this court has indicated that, for example, minor traffic tickets wouldn't be applicable. You're correct. No, it's not specifically aimed, but I would submit, and I think the Langan case lays out, we're looking at malum in se crime.
The felonies that relate to the injury is what it's saying.
Correct.
Specifically.
Correct. Absolutely. And drunk driving would fit right in that because it is a significant incident. And I think if it was a situation of all that it does is give rise to a presumption of negligence, or you establish negligence but then comparative fault, you might as well apply it to traffic tickets then, because the defense is left with that option of saying, okay, we were negligent, but there was a second proximate cause here and comparative fault. The only reason why it's definitely not going to apply in those minor situations is because the penalties are that significant in saying liability and negligence is to be imposed. Thank you very much. Appreciate it on behalf of my client and myself as well.
Well, thank you, counsel. Very interesting case. The matter will stand submitted, and this court will stand in recess until the